Welcome to Straight Thinking, a GPS for the Christian mind, teaching people how to think, not just what to think. This is Average Joe Aguirre with theologian and philosopher Kenneth Samples and physicist Dave Rogstad. On today's podcast, does God care about what we eat? We'll explore that question with Dr. James Painter, nutritionist and visiting scholar here at RTB. Jim Painter has been a registered dietitian since 1980 and has served as the director of nutrition research for the California Raisin Marketing Board and as nutrition advisor for Sun-Made Raisin Growers of California, Wonderful Pistachios and Almonds, and the National Dairy Council. Greetings, Jim. I'm hungry already after reading about your bio there.
It's quite a life. I get to go meeting to meeting to meeting and eat.
Oh, that sounds terrific. Yeah. Well, welcome to the podcast. And Ken, maybe you can give us a context for why we have Jim with us today.
Yeah. Jim, welcome to our program.
Thanks.
It's good to have you here with us. It's been great to listen to some of your talks on nutrition and diet. I'd like to explore a few issues with you in our time together. Joe and Dave, I'd like to examine a little bit the question of how important the body is to Christianity. And let me kind of dive in there if I could. Jim, in the second and third century, Christianity faced a major heresy called Gnosticism. And interestingly enough, one of the central features of Gnosticism was that the physical body, the physical world was evil and the spirit was good. This kind of Gnostic ideas were part of the Eastern mysticism. But Gnosticism was a major challenge to Christianity because if matter is either illusory or evil, what does that then do to creation? What does it do to the incarnation, which John in his gospel writes right from the get-go? And what about the crucifixion and the bodily resurrection? It would seem it's a major challenge in that way. But we could even extend it a little bit in terms of worldview. In Eastern mysticism, the body is not essential. It's the soul. It's the spirit.
Right.
But then you flip that with naturalism, materialistic naturalism, and the body is everything. The physical universe is everything. What have you experienced when it comes to the average everyday Christian? And I guess the question I'm asking here is this. I sometimes think that maybe evangelicals think the real me is my soul. That's really me. The body, I am a soul. I happen to have a body. And sometimes I think the implication of that is my body isn't nearly as important, and maybe I won't treat it as a temple. What's been your experience? Is there anything to that?
You know, I think I've seen the same kind of a thing, and that is people have these wildly divergent opinions about what we should do as Christians and non-Christians. And there's a group of people, usually the people that are not Christians, that, like you said, the naturalist, that's all they have. And so once you're gone, you're gone.
Yeah.
And I better keep this thing in good shape because it's what I am. And so you've got this group over here that says, that's really me, and there's nothing else but that for me. And so you see some of those people are sometimes the most ardent exercisers. You know, they just want to take care of their body and eat right. And then you have this group of people in the East, the Eastern mystical whole thing, where, you know, they're doing the chanting and the body's really not real. It's the real thing is the spirit that's back there. And those people seem to be very devout then looking at all of that. They might treat the body harsh because it's not really what they're interested in. And they want to then, you know, get to know nirvana by, you know, developing their spirit.
Yeah.
And so it's fascinating that difference, how we've seen that throughout the centuries. And so as most Christians today, really, they, especially in America, we want to keep our body pretty, you know? We want people to go, what a pretty body.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, aren't you a pretty person? Yes, what a nice shape you have. And everybody's outwardly focused about that. And so I see a lot of people, especially my students, and so I have – you know, have had hundreds and hundreds of dietetic students, these young ladies that want to be in shape, they want to keep their bodies in shape. But it seems like it's for the wrong reason. They want to be pretty. I want people to look at my flesh and go, wow, what nice flesh that is. And for Christians, it's different. I mean, we have a different reason. And what I love about the Bible is it's balanced. It doesn't get stuck on one side or the other. And so people will take Bible scripture and prove this side or this side. But really what it's doing is giving you the balance of where you should be. And so why should we care about the body? You know, 1 Corinthians 6 says, do you not know that your body is the temple of the Holy Spirit? That blows my mind right there. Like, really? The God of the universe is going to live in here? Yeah. And he lives in here. So our body is the temple of the Holy Spirit who is in us, who's given to us by God. We're not our own. Wow. We're not our own. So we've got this body. It looks like it's ours, and it has been ours, and we accept Christ, and then all of a sudden the Spirit's in there. Now we're not ours anymore. We've been bought with a price. Oh, my goodness, what a responsibility. I've been bought with a price. Yeah. I have to glorify God in this body. And so that's the basis that I use when I'm thinking about nutrition. Nutrition isn't everything. Some people, if your body's it, then it's everything.
Yeah.
My grandfather used to say, if you have your health, son, you've got 95% of everything. Really? Is that true? But from his point of view, it was, you know. But from our point of view as Christians, the body's very important. But it isn't most important. You don't want to just focus on the body. You know, and I love the scripture, how it keeps focusing us up. You know, in Colossians, it says,
seek those things which are above where Christ is.
Right. Yeah. Seek those things. So that's got to be the main purpose. And so if we're going to work with our body, what's the reason for it? Well, we need to be seeking those things above, and his Spirit's in us, and so our body's very important because it's a real creation, like Kent was saying. It's not figment, it's not, you know, illusory. It's real because it's a creation. God created it, but we're supposed to take care of it. So, you know, I agree with what you said. You can get on ditches on either side, and over the years, you know, the church and everyone else has gotten into one of the ditches.
You know, there's an interesting point that Thomas Aquinas makes. Thomas argued that human beings are a unity of body and soul, and he even proposed that in the intermediate state, so that would be after death but before the resurrection, that human beings in that state are not fully human because our design of humanness is enfleshment. And so maybe part of this issues that we as Christians face has to do with the idea of maybe not thinking broadly enough about who we are as human beings. That I remember when I was very sick a number of years ago, having brain abscesses and then having pain medication, I couldn't think very clearly. It struck me that my brain isn't just one little insignificant part of me. Yeah. It's a critical part of me. So maybe that bifurcation that we make, maybe we need good theology to kind of help us in that. Let me ask you, though, about a point you've mentioned, and I find it very interesting. It's this question about aesthetics over health. I remember one day, I'll admit my own vanity. I saw a photo of me, and I saw that I was overweight, and it bothered me more how I looked, I think. At least I thought initially more about how I looked than I thought about my health. And that's an interesting point, that part of wanting to be healthy is because we want to be perceived as right, being attractive, when we may not necessarily think quickly enough about what is it doing to our brain, what is it doing to our heart, what about the quality of our life. How do you address that with Christians who want to get healthy but maybe think more about aesthetics than health?
You know, that I see that all the time, and the fact that Christians, like the world, we want to look good. And so that sometimes drives us to do it. But it also, when we get sick and all of a sudden we can't function, mm-hmm, that drives us to do it too.
Yeah.
It's amazing how many men in middle age will, after a heart attack, do whatever you tell them to do. You know, it's, we just do it. Because like I remember I was almost dead, so you tell me to do this and I'll do it. And over a period of 3 months maybe, 4 months, all of a sudden you forget that happened to me. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, we are driven to do it. I see young people generally do that. I mean, I'm old now and I say, I don't care. You know, you're old and gray and bald, I know. And so you don't look good. That's fine, you know. My son said, he said, you're looking old, Dad. Of course, I am old. I'm 64. I'm old. And so that drives us to do it many times when we see it. But you've got these middle-aged men then that don't seem to – they're not interested in that thing. They'll joke, this is my beer belly. This is my six-pack.
It costs me a lot of money
to do it. And they'll joke about it. Like it's – so the aesthetics thing for middle-aged men, it doesn't move them at all. But the health thing does.
Yeah.
As soon as something happens and they've been able to do everything and now they can't do it, then they get interested in it again. And – it's an amazing thing as I look at the scripture, how many times God said, remember. You know, he yeah. sets up, something happens and he sets up a pile of stones, remember. You know, I look at the Jews and they come, they follow, they don't, they follow, they don't, they follow, they don't. And I think, what was wrong with these people? But it was actually a generation. Generation did, generation didn't. You know, and I think, man, I kind of do that within like 25 minutes. Hmm. You know, I can be trusting in God here and my brain will go over here and I'll do this. So, yeah, a lot of it's remembering it. I think how you get there is important. You know, I want to be better. I want to look better. Okay. But when that takes over the spiritual part of who I am, whose I am, and what I should be doing here on the planet, then it's out of balance. I think it's fine to be interested in that. But again, sometimes we get in one ditch or the other.
Yeah. Well, that worldview issue, too, I think that's quite a dramatic contrast in the sense that if you embrace a kind of an Eastern mystical worldview, let's say you're Hindu, a Buddhist, Confucianism, Taoism, the soulishness, the spirit, is so much more important. The body is something to kind of be overcome. Mm-hmm. The Gnostics thought that salvation was the soul escaping the body. That was salvation. Now, I'd like to again contrast that, though, with a Western materialistic naturalism. Not all naturalists, by the way, are necessarily materialists, although it seems to me it's kind of hard. You don't have a lot of options there. But with naturalism and materialism, I mean, that's all there is. Everything is either reducible to the material and the physical, and there is no kind of soulish. But Christianity has a tremendous place for the non-physical, the spiritual, the soul, and yet the body is very significant. I mean, even before the Gnostics, there were Docetists that John seemed to know, who, and I think that's clearly why both in his gospel and in his first epistle, he talks about, has Jesus come in the flesh? Talks about it as being truth, because the docetus in that Greek word means to seem or to appear. So right. Jesus seemed to be human, but he wasn't. And I wonder if that's not a very powerful way of kind of contrasting these, could we call them extreme worldviews? Spirit is everything. The material is everything. Whereas in Christianity, you have a infinite, eternal, tripersonal, spiritual being who takes on a human nature. And so that's a powerful contrast. And maybe that's a good motivation for us to think more deeply about what does it mean to be human? Mm-hmm. Let me ask you a very practical question, Jim. When I spend time in every morning, I try to spend some time confessing my sins to God, because I have many of them, and I like to keep a short list with the Lord. Though I'm very cognizant, the list is probably longer, and I'm not fully aware of them. Though Dave and Joe kind of helped to remind me from time to time.
You resemble Martin Luther in that regard.
that's exactly right. You know, one of the things that comes in the seven deadly sins, so I'm reaching into the medieval Christian world now, the seven deadly sins in alphabetical order: anger, envy, gluttony, greed, lust, pride, and sloth. My dad thought I was a sloth when I was a when I was a boy. I think all fathers at some point think their son isn't going to amount to anything. At least my dad thought that. Mm-hmm. Well, there's two of the sins there that we seemingly struggle with the body, the urges of the body.
Right.
I would identify gluttony as one of them and lust as another one. Mm-hmm. As I've thought about these particular sins and my own struggle with them, is that in some ways we are struggling with the impulses of our body. We are struggling with the tendency. I struggle with sometimes eating the wrong things and then sometimes struggle with eating too much of even the right things.
Right.
So there's a struggle in that. Lust as well is a struggle, your impulse to think impure thoughts. I wonder if you could kind of talk with us, little Jim, in terms of diet, in the context maybe of sanctification. I mean, some of us struggle with our weight, and other people who are relatively thin, now there may be good reasons they're thin, they may have a much better diet,
right.
They may have better genetics, they may have all kinds of good things. But it seems to me that sanctification has to involve the recognition that throughout our life we fail and that we can continually go back to the grace of God and find forgiveness. I'll give you an example of that. I every once in a while I bump into people who think I ought to stop sinning, and which I think I should, but... as Augustine said, some of us cannot not sin. That is, until glorification, we're going to struggle with sin. But I guess my point here is that we need to constantly be able to go back and confess our sins. But gluttony is one of the few sins you can see.
Right.
And you know, some thin guy like you, this guy's got muscle. He's 64, but he looks good. You might have the you might look at me and say, Ken's heavy. You know, how do you encourage people, in light of good theology, to address those kinds of issues where they struggle either with eating too much, not exercising? What's some of your thinking there? I like to help people in life by giving them a good theology to follow as well.
Right. You know, one of the things that I like to look back to is Paul. And I think, man, he's the one that got all the revelation and wrote half the New Testament.
Yeah.
And I think that's amazing. And then he says, the good things I want to do, I don't do. Mm. The evil things I don't want to do, I keep doing them. Who's going to deliver me from this? And thank God for the Lord Jesus Christ who came and did it. Now, I look at that and I think, I get frustrated because I want to do things and I don't. And I think, man, I'm never going to hit the place where I've made it. You know, I think I've covered this stuff that I've had trouble with.
Move over, Paul.
That's right. But if Paul's right there, I'm in good hands because he was struggling with it his whole life.
Wow.
And so I see people come to me and they think, well, you've got it right. And I say, okay, let me just tell you that I don't have trouble with alcohol or sex, lust. That's not my thing. Desiring to do things I don't want, I shouldn't do, you know, spending time and things I shouldn't do. My big issue in life is food. You know, it's my big struggle because I know, you know, a yard's worth and I practice a foot's worth. You know, and I'm always aware of my shortcoming. The thing that humbles me before God all the time is the daily issue I have with food, like yesterday. You know, you talked about good food can be, you know, you can do too much of it. So, you know, I've been talking my way through lunches, and I haven't had many lunches here because I've just been busy. And so yesterday you had a lunch.
We put you to work.
You put me to work, like morning to night. It's been really good. And so we have this scholar call, and they have all this food come in, and I have a plate. That's a pretty good plate. I have another plate. I'm really full, and that's all I needed. But the lust of my body's thinking, they're talking, I'm not busy, I get a third plate. After my third plate.
There went my plate.
I ate everybody's food, and then I start thinking, I don't feel so good. And I thought, oh, God, Lord, how did I do this again? You know, I do it again. And so I think it's good for people to know that I stay fairly thin, but I have gotten more and less and more and less, and it is a continual battle that humbles me every day. You know, I'm a nutritionist. If I can't look the part, then I should just shut up and not say anything. I can't do it, you know? And so it's like, but the struggle's still there.
Yeah.
And so the first thing I like to tell people, because so many women have come in my office over the 40 years that I've done this, and they'll say, you know, I'm just fat. My mom's fat. My dad's fat. My brother's fat. You know, our whole family is just overweight. And you know, I've tried every diet. I've tried every one. And they don't work. And I am hopeless. Mm. It's not a good place to be. I mean, you've been sick and hopeless. And,
yeah.
You know, about 20 years ago when I just got this thing and I got to a point after 5 months where I said, God, I'm done. I want to go, you know. Because I had gone to Europe 3 times and I thought I picked up a bug. I stopped digesting food for 5 months. I would eat things, run right through me. I lost 40 pounds. I don't have much to lose. And so, you know, I can't eat, can't sleep, can't hardly do anything. I said, God, I'm just tired of this. And then they did a gluten antigen test, said, we think you might be celiac. No, I eat bread every day. That might be the problem, you know. And so I quit eating it, and 3 days it clears up.
Wow.
I think, wow, that was kind of amazing. You know, and so I've been to those struggles. I've seen that. I've had so many people come to me, and the first thing I tell them is, you know, Paul struggled with it. He didn't give up. And I have struggled with it. I still do, like yesterday, and I don't give up. Yeah. There's never a time to quit, because everybody I've seen that's been able to lose weight tried it 100 times before it worked.
Wow.
You know, and then eventually something works. And I tried to look over the years, well, what worked? It's different for different people. You know, whatever caused them to be able to do it. But the things that they did is they didn't quit, you know, and it looked hopeless, but it doesn't matter if it looks hopeless. And there's just things as a Christian that gives us an advantage that other people don't have, you know. And so I usually get into 2 Corinthians 10:5. We're casting down imaginations. And every high thing raised up against God's knowledge, taking every thought captive to obey Christ. So you just told me I can't do it. No one's done it. It's hopeless for me. That's not true. I mean, I can tell you. I can give you examples of dozens of people that did it. And so the truth is that God says we can do all things. You mean I can eat right? Yep, you can pick up the spoon correctly and eat the right amount. But I haven't. I know. I haven't either. You know, I've done it wrong thousands of times. But it doesn't mean that I don't have the ability if I look to him for the ability. And like I said, it humbles me every day that I go down. Now, I'll have some good days. I think that was a pretty good day. I just ate what you wanted me to eat, and I did it.
Yeah.
Yes. But then, you know, a few days later, it's not so good.
Yeah.
Go ahead, Joe.
Yeah, I have a couple of questions for you, Jim. One is going to be along these lines. Is there a biblical basis or guidelines for how we should eat? But I'll table that for a second. The first question will be, what about somebody who might say, I heard what you said earlier, Dr. Painter, about trying to strike a proper balance. I wonder if you might help me in that regard, because I am a Christian who likes to exercise a lot, who tries to eat right and all that. And I happen to look better than I would otherwise, but that's not my primary goal. My primary goal is to preserve this body that God has given me so that I can use it to his glory. There are things to accomplish while we are here on earth, and I think that's better done while I'm taking care of this temple.
Right.
So I wonder if you might help a person who's thinking along those lines, and then I'll ask the second question in a moment.
Well, it actually kind of goes into the second question of is there a plan? There is so much, it's hard to find truth. You know, people want, okay, I need to do this. How do I do it? You know, what's the method I get to? And you've got all this conflicting stuff out there. I mean, you're a Christian, and you want to find out what's truth, and you have all this conflicting data. What is truth? What does the Bible actually say about it? And does the Bible give us guidance? And it does. I mean, the first thing is, I think our bodies are fearfully and wonderfully made. to run on what? What God made for us. And so when I look at that, I think, over the years, what has been the problem? Well, there's two problems right now, two big ones, and that's trans fat. Well, where did it come from? Well, we made it, you know, and we fed it to ourselves in huge volumes in the 20s and 30s and 40s and 50s and 60s. And all of a sudden now, in the last few years, it's come to the realization that that really was the problem. That's one big problem. And the second thing is we keep refining foods. We have highly refined foods. And so what's the problem? The stuff we mess with. You know, and so 55% of our diet is highly processed. 55%. I live on South Padre Island, Texas, and so I'm walking along the beach, and there's just hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of people, and they all have bags and bags and bags and drinks and Cokes and drinks and chips and cookies and crackers and pretzels and all that stuff. It's all highly processed, all of it. The entire day, those human beings did not get anything that God created. And so the biggest deal is eat whole foods. That's the first thing. And you think, I mean, God had that in the beginning. He just gave you whole foods. And it didn't matter if you were an Eskimo having seal meat and seal blubber for breakfast and whale meat and whale blubber for lunch and a blubber smoothie in the afternoon.
You just, yum, yum.
You just blubbered it the whole day.
A blubber smoothie. And so, that's pretty good, Jim.
Give me one of those.
So those people just eat meat and fat. And then the people over here in India, you know, they don't have any fat. They're eating twigs and roots and berries and whatever they can get their hand on with no fat. They're pretty healthy. And even the weirdest ones, like the Maasai Indians, Africans, and they take a cow and they poke it in the neck and they bleed it, and then they go to the other end and they milk it, and they mix the two together and make a warm, curdled blood and milk smoothie.
Oh, boy.
And they drink that. Isn't that the smoothie that you want to have?
I haven't seen that at Subway.
It's not usually available. But the thing is, this body is made so amazingly that if you put real food into it, you can do about anything. One day, this is about a year ago, a guy after me came up with the chimpanzee diet. And I said, really? What is that? He said, well, it's like a chimp. You know, they eat one big bunch of food at a time. They climb this tree, eat all the bananas they want, come down and have sex. They climb the next tree, eat a bunch of apples, come down and have sex. They come up with the next tree, eat a bunch of avocados, go home, go to bed.
I'm thinking,
I'm thinking that's your plan?
Oh, boy.
That's the plan. Now, the point is that this guy would eat a bunch of bananas for breakfast, a bunch of apples for lunch, and a head of lettuce for dinner, and he was pretty healthy, which means you can be really weird in how you select your food. And as long as it's really food, you can do really well with it, which it just amazes me that people are talking about all these issues about what to eat. But really, the basic thing is just eat it as close to the way God made it as possible because it works to fuel the body that God made. Isn't that amazing?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Now, Jim, there are some people who tend to look at food a little bit differently in this regard. We have made such a mess of things, as you described, by processing so much that maybe we need to avoid all of that and go back to leafy-type things or a vegetarian diet. After all, God gave us every green thing to eat. I wonder if we're going too far in one direction there or if that's good guidance to maybe eat of vegetables or vegetarian-type diet.
You know, when I look at the Scripture— and I was talking with Fuzz yesterday about the food laws that are just fascinating. There's lots of science behind those food laws, what fish you can eat, what you can't eat, what, you know, animals. And there's some interesting science things behind that. But the very first thing he said in Genesis 1:29 is that, you know, every herb-bearing seed, this shall be food for you. He's talking about plants and seeds and the things that make themselves from the seeds. And so that is the basis of the diet. And it should be the basis. And what happens is that when you look at all these doctors, you know, you've got a group of them, and I've got a diagram on a podcast that I just did, or a blog for RTV, and it talks about where all the diet doctors agree with the Bible. And so you've got the one group, I put it on the y-axis up and down, and it's got the paleo people that say it's animals that what you need to eat. And he go, no, the vegan people are going, no, you don't want to eat any meat. And then you've got the people on the x-axis over here that say, fat's the thing you need. It's the keto diet. And they go, no, it's this no-fat, low-fat diet. And then you've got the two people, Atkins, that says eat a lot of animals and a lot of fat. And you've got Ornish that says eat no animals and no fat. And so everybody's pointing to the macronutrient percentage of the diet. And they all have good evidence that they're right. And so I've looked at that and I thought, wait a minute, there's something that they all do in common. Well, the first thing we talked about, they are not eating the sad American diet, the standard American diet that's highly processed. They all say eat whole foods. So that's the first thing. And then the second thing is what you just brought up, and that is the basis of the diet should be, you know, whole green plants. There's amazing reasons to eat green leafies and to eat berries, you know, and to eat seeds. Seeds are growing. They're going to be the thing that's going to create a whole tree. And so to eat all those things is the basis. And then someone will say, well, should I be vegan or should I be paleo? You missed my point. My point is I don't think that matters. I think you need to not eat the stuff that we highly process and make sure you eat these leafy things. Should I have animal or protein? I don't care. You know, be paleo, be vegan, but eat whole foods. You can be a vegan and have fudge all day long, you know, and have fudge breakfast, lunch, and dinner. And then should I eat a lot of fat or no fat? You know, that probably makes a difference in some areas, but generally the point is focus on what's important, and that is, you know, don't eat the stuff that's highly processed, but you can, and it's like you can eat anything. It's what you do the most of. If you just love Cheetos, eat a Cheetos. You know, have a bag of Cheetos.
There's my green light, Ken.
But the thing is you shouldn't have Cheetos at every meal or every day, you know, and you use them as a treat. The issue is we use something as a treat and then it becomes a daily thing. Yeah. So yeah, I think the Bible gives us guidance on just eat whole foods. It does have a basis of greens. But then God says, you know, after the flood, here's meat. Here's how you eat it. Some is better than others. And here's the plan. And so meat is certainly in there. It's not like you get to some of these Eastern religions and it's like the spiritual thing is not to eat meat. Really? Why? You know, I don't get it, and I usually don't have a good point. And everybody that talks to me about being not eating meat or not drinking milk, it's weird. I mean, I was working for sorghum, and the animal rights people were in a booth next to me, and somehow we got onto dairy. And they said, oh, that's so horrible. Why? Well, they treat those cows so bad. I've been in a lot of dairy farms, and they treat them like they're children. You know, they name them. They milk them by name, and they know them all. And they said it's so cruel the way they hook them up to the machine to milk them. I said, I have two daughter-in-laws. They hook themselves up to a machine and milk themselves. And the lady goes, well, it's still cruel. How? What's your reason behind I can't eat meat? I have vegan tendencies. You know, I would left to my own devices because I like all that stuff. I would just eat it. But you know, I went out with Fuzz and we had brats and sausage.
Sounds like a Fuzz run a day. So,
you know, I thought, this is good. I went out there and we had an October thing. And the thing is I generally don't eat it a lot, but I think it's fine to eat, you know. So yeah, the Bible gives us guidelines on what to do. And each one of those people usually has focused on natural, on the body, and on food over everything. Before they come up with that, or they have focused on the environment, and that's the most important thing, the environment, and because of that, you can't have dairy, you can't have meat, you can't have this. And so it seems like they've got a wrong perspective on making something the key thing, which it isn't.
Jim, I've got a question for you. Is it possible that the struggle that some people have with weight loss, now I'm speaking of human beings in general, is a matter of scarcity? That is it possible God has created our bodies in such a way that it moves in the direction of preserving our life? And is it possible that in some sense this is protective that God has put in? God doesn't want us to starve to death. So sometimes losing weight may be part of that. Am I off base?
I don't know. Say that again. You're talking about is the fact that we maintain and gain weight, is that kind of a natural thing God put in? Is that the question?
Yeah.
I think it is. And so it's balanced out to function because we are supposed to be able to eat food and it gets scarce. And then we have stored fat. And so fat is vital. I mean, I see some women that just want to get skinny, skinny, skinny. And so men can get down to a body fat of like 1. When my little boys were little, they didn't even register. You don't have any fat. You're just skin and bone and muscle. And then women, if they start thinking, oh, man, I need to get really thin, and they get a body fat of less than like 12%, which is a good, really kind of a large body fat for men, they quit menstruating. Their body goes, wait a minute, you're so skinny, you can't even reproduce. And so their body starts shutting down. And so fat is vital. I've seen it with little girls. They're skinny, and all of a sudden they start to develop, and they start getting fat. And this whole fat, you know, I can't be fat.
Yeah.
And so they're scared of the fat, but that's a woman. You get shape, you hold fat, you have fat for various reasons. It's for protection for your body and to help you produce the things you need to produce. You need the fat, and it has gotten weird, this whole idea of anti-fat. Fat in the diet isn't bad, and fat on your body isn't bad either. And as you get older, fat is a good thing, because when you hit an illness, the amount of, and you can't eat or something's happening, then it's the fat reserves you have. And so as people do get older, especially in their 70s and 80s, you know, especially women that just don't have much reserve, then cancer doesn't kill them. You know, starvation kills them, because they just can't take in enough food, and they don't have enough reserve. So that's a very good point. It's a mechanism God created, you know, and it's just gone overboard the way I see it with abundance. And so whenever any country gets enough money to be able to do what they want to do and want to spend it on food and their old nature takes over, then they start gaining weight, too much weight. It's like our country, we were skinny for 10,000 years or however long we've been around, I'm not sure. You know.
Thousands.
Thousands, whatever. And so, you know, when that happens, we start eating more. And so we started getting bigger in the United States, and then part of Europe started getting bigger, and then part of Asia starting to get bigger. And so when we have enough money and we can do what we want and we have highly refined foods that don't tell our body we've had enough, those two combinations, they just overdo the natural process that God had there. And if you ate the whole foods, it wouldn't be a problem. You know, and if you controlled yourself so that you weren't just lusting after food, then it would work fine, and you have fat. And it is just amazing, some women that especially, because men generally don't do that, but would just want to be so thin, it's unhealthy.
Yeah.
You know?
Now, curiously, when you look at old pictures or old drawings, or so you get some insight into the way people were, you know, 100 years ago, or
right,
they seem to be a lot heavier. That the ideal, you know, if you look at paintings of women,
right,
they seem to be a lot, you know, the ideal body seemed to be a lot heavier than they are today. Was that because they didn't pay as much attention to that, to being skinny or to looking in a certain
right
way?
Or was that an art form?
I think it's an art form too, but the idea, if you look at women, and they were just voluptuous. They were round. You
right
look at all the paintings
yeah
in right Italy, and you've got these very, you know, round women with lots of fat on their hips and in their breasts, and they're just big women. And we look at that like, you know, what's that? Well, that was beauty for almost ever, you know? And then when you looked at the people that had weight, they were the wealthy people. So people liked it. And so when you talked about the fatness of the land and you know, making the land, all this fat talk, when I was into this low-fat thing, you know, when I was a young nutritionist, it was fat's bad. And mm-hmm. And I have to apologize to people for lying to them in the 70s and 80s and 90s, because we taught that fat was bad. Eating fat's bad, being fat is bad, having fat on your body's bad. And then when the whole thing came in with Twiggy, you know, it's just weird. If you go back and look at Twiggy and you Google it, then, man, that woman is just bone. Mm-hmm. So somehow that cultural thing switched. Up until that time, it was always women that had shape to them. And like I said, it's biological. You can get a man down to 1% body fat and healthy as can be. You get a woman down to anything less than 12 and they become very unhealthy. Mm-hmm. And so it's a biological thing where women need to have fat on their body. Yeah, that's a good question.
Let's talk a little bit about diet and exercise. Jim, I went to my doctor and he told me that when it comes to weight loss, it's 95 diet, 5 exercise. Now, of course, he said, look, you need to exercise for your brain, your heart, helps blood sugar stay low, cholesterol. He was all for exercising. But he said the data indicates that weight loss is primarily what we eat. Talk to us a little bit about that balance, that issue, right, exercising and eating.
You know, it's funny, in Back to the Future, he says, we run. Why do you run? For fun. They go, that's stupid. Why are you running for fun? Don't you? You're running from an animal? No, we just run for fun. And the guy back in the Old West is going, what's wrong with you guys? And so the idea is that, yeah, generally we're built to exercise. And if you don't use it, you lose it in any realm. You just don't. you can't keep it. And so exercise is very important, but you can always out-eat your exercise, always.
Wow.
You know, and there's just no way you can't, because I feel sorry for my little thin 100-pound dietetic students. They're just running on the treadmill, and they spend an hour at it, and they eat a half a candy bar, and it's gone. Now, you get a big guy that's exercising like that, and he can burn up, 1,000 calories, and he can eat, multiple candy bars to make up for it. And so, yes, exercise is important. If you don't use it, you lose it. It's very good for lots of things, for just, your neurochemical balances in your body to have that. But if you're talking about weight, it really is more determined by what you eat. And so I don't tell people to count. Should I count calories? No. People didn't do that for 10,000 years. And nobody that ever does it that I see sticks with it for more than a short period of time. So what's the answer? The studies that we've done over the past 25 years have been on portion control. All right, and not just saying I'm going to eat less, because I don't, But if I have a choice, since the environment has changed, how can I help myself in this new environment of abundance eat right? And so I'll tell people, there's a number of studies we've done. There's a movie we have out, a video called Portion Size Me. And we did a study, we put candy kisses on the table, and then we put them in the desk drawer 4 inches below to a group of secretaries. And they ate 30% less when it was out of sight. Hmm. We're on a seafood diet. We see it, we eat it. And then we made it inconvenient. We just put it in a drawer up about 2 meters away, and people had to get up and get it. And so that decreased consumption by 60%. So, yes, we can always out-eat our exercise. What we eat is most important. And when you look at portions, we are in this huge area of consumption. It was not the McDonald's brothers. It was the guy that worked for them. Who's the guy that did McDonald's? The movie's about him.
Ray Kroc?
Yeah, Ray Kroc. Mm-hmm. So Ray Kroc figured, if you have a pretty dress and you want to have someone buy another pretty dress, you can make a prettier dress and they'll buy two dresses. But if you feed somebody and they're full and you go, here's a candy bar, they go, I don't want to eat that candy bar, I'm full. It's a really good candy bar. I am full. You don't get it. I don't want a candy bar. So he realized you had to front end load this whole thing. And so he's the one that came up with these big portions. Give people so many calories when they're looking at it and they're hungry, and make them buy more than they need. And has that worked?
Oh, yeah.
it's really worked to have people eat more than they should. Mm. So,
yeah, I have a question that might sound like I'm pushing back on something you said earlier, but you talked about processed foods not being good for us in recent times. Now, somebody might say, oh, wait a minute, Dr. Painter, aren't you a consultant for some of these companies? You know that they're trying to feed people. And if someone worked for a relief agency that's international in scope, they might say, hey, the processing of foods and the preserving of foods allows us to feed the globe.
Right.
So I wonder if you might respond to that.
That is an excellent question, Average Joe, and I would have that question too. And the point is I said highly processed, and that means it has colors, flavors, textures, things that are added to it to make it look like something else. And that's just all the cookies, pies, cakes, chips, all that kind of stuff. Usually they're low in nutrients. Almost always they're low in fiber. And then typically, they just don't have the quality of a whole food. So everything is processed. I work for Raisins. Like you said when it got on here, I was the director of nutrition for the Dancing Raisins for a decade. And so that's processed. You take the grape, you throw it on a piece of paper on the ground in Fresno, California, and it sits there for 2 or 3 weeks, and the sun hits it and dries it out. And then it goes to the factory, they wash it off and try and catch anything that shouldn't be in there. And then you eat it. So that's processed, but it's minimally processed, and you haven't lost any nutrients. And then same thing with canning. You can can something, and generally you get it at the point of ripeness, you cut it, prepare it, can it, and you preserve it by heat. And so everything that was in the original is there, with the exception of some of the antioxidant nutrients that get oxidized in the process. But you lose those when you chop it and cut it and before you eat it anyway, if you don't do it quickly. And so is processing important? Yes, it is. It's extremely important. But it goes bad sometimes, like in the teens and the 20s last century, we started processing flour. And so we thought, man, you take the germ out, get rid of all that oil and all the bran off it, you can take this white flour and it can last forever. Turn it into a Twinkie, it'll last 100 years. And so they've done studies. You can mummify it, and it just sits there because no bug's going to want to eat it because it's a Twinkie.
Now I know what to do with my attic.
That's right. And so the idea of processing, that's a very good question, because processing isn't bad. It's what happens, and sometimes, like the flour, it goes bad. And in the early part of last century, you know, John Harvey Kellogg came up with Kellogg's to try and bring that whole back together, you know, and still preserve it in a different way. And Sylvester Graham, the father of the Graham cracker — Graham means whole wheat flour — he said, "What God has joined together, let no man put asunder." He was talking about the germ and the endosperm and the bran, keeping it all together. So yeah, that's a very good question, because yes, processing is important, and certain processes do really well. It's when we go past that and we start manufacturing things, and you can turn into a Frankenfood, you know, that you've put all the stuff together that really doesn't even go together, and try and get it to humans to eat. And food companies know now that we like salt, we like sugar, you know, we like fat. Okay, that's all you need. Make a donut. It's white flour and sugar and fat, and it's fried in fat. And then it's covered with sugar, and it's sprinkled with sugar. And well, that's really good. I like, you're getting hungry now, aren't you? They're all getting hungry here.
Dunkin's.
Dunkin' Donut. And the thing is I'm not opposed to a donut. I'm opposed to the donut having you. And so if you want to eat a donut, eat a donut. But, I mean, if you have to have a donut every morning for breakfast, there's something wrong there. You need to change, because donuts are fine. I'm not opposed to a donut because people know this isn't probably good for me. I probably shouldn't have many. If you give a donut and a salad, say, which one should you have? Well, I should have that one. Yeah. I mean, everybody will say that. Nobody's being fooled. Mm-hmm. It bothers me more when people advertise things that you think are healthy and they're not. That's not good.
Yeah. What about the idea that, you know, this concept of processed foods, the low-fat craze led to more sugar in food and has led to, you know, more diabetes, for instance.
Right.
Can you comment on that?
Yeah. First thing I'll do is humbly apologize to you and the world that I told people to eat low fat in the 70s, 80s, and 90s. Mm. When Snackwells came out, I remember letting my kids, you can have Snackwells. Now, I'm not an idiot. I know. I'm a nutritionist. What's Snackwells made of? Sugar and white flour. Is that good for you? No. But it's not fat. And so it's okay to eat because it doesn't have any fat. I think how easy. You can be deceived. I mean, I was so deceived as a young man that I did that. I fed it to my children, and they lived. And the amazing thing is they procreated, and I have grandchildren now. You know, but I fed them that stuff thinking what's not. So many times trying to avoid something and doing something and avoiding something isn't as important as what you actually do. You know, and so the whole idea of Snackwells, I would eat a whole box. You know, there was only like 6 cookies in a box because they each had their own little chair because there was no fat in them. They turned to dust if they got shaken at all. So you got these little very expensive containers of Snackwells. And so that was just a weird thing. You know, fat makes you fat. You know, it has twice the calories of protein and carb. Right. Fat makes you fat. And in your arteries, there's fat and cholesterol. It must be the fat and cholesterol that makes that. That's not true. You know, it's not the fat, it's not the cholesterol you eat that makes cholesterol form in your arteries. And so,
what is it that makes it?
Well, there's a variety of things. The number one thing, I think, and I've been researching this just for the last year, and I've gotten all the articles on it, and it's inflammation. And so if you look at what's happening to an artery, and you get fat and cholesterol get in there, as long as it doesn't burst, it usually doesn't do anything. So what causes that thing to burst is inflammation. It's inflamed, and all of a sudden it just breaks open, and then it clots, and then that's it. And so inflammation then is a normal thing. If you don't have inflammation, you know, you get a little bug bite here, or you get some kind of infection in there, and just takes over your body, and you're dead. So your body inflammation comes, it revs up, and it kind of, you know, brings in white cells, and it forms around that thing, and it kind of traps it, and it tries to get rid of it. So inflammation is good. We live by it. But if our bodies are always living a little bit of inflammation, just like if we're always fearful and we're always upset and we're supposed to flight or fight, you know, but if we do that constantly, we're always in a little bit of fear, a little bit of anxiety, and our body's always revved up, that's bad. And so inflammation seems to be kept in check by whole foods. Whole foods that have nutrients and phytonutrients that help our body keep our inflammation process in line. And what's the most pro-inflammatory? White flour, white sugar, the highly processed foods that are added. And it may not even be those things that do it. It's just that they come without any of the nutrients and the phytonutrients to be able to keep all that inflammation in balance. And so the biggest thing, I think, is a pro-inflammatory diet. And there's so many research articles coming out just in the last year that people are getting that, but it's going to take another 20 years to get to your doctor, and to, you know, because it just takes a while to change.
Jim, one more topic I want to touch before we run out of time. Fasting. I listened to a talk you gave yesterday where you talked about sometimes people adopt eating 5 days a week, fasting 2 days a week. Talk to us a little bit about fasting, and talk to us a little bit as well. One of the things I don't like about following my diet too strictly is feeling hungry all the time.
Right.
To talk to us a little bit about, this is a biblical topic. Jesus talks right. about fasting.
Yeah. You know, it's fascinating. If you just search fasting in the Bible, 95% of it or more is in the Old Testament. Mm. And I thought, Jesus didn't tell us to fast. He didn't give us guidelines that we should fast. He just assumed we would. He said, when you fast. And then he clarified it by, don't fast like the hypocrites, saying, I'm fasting, poor me, aren't I spiritual, poor you. He said, no, wash your face, go out there, and then you'll get your reward from God, and you won't get it from man. So all he did was say, of course you're to do it. And they said to his disciples, how come your disciples don't fast? They will. They don't fast while I'm here, but when the bridegroom's gone, they're going to fast. And if you look at Paul and you look at Acts, there's a number of times when they fasted and prayed and sent somebody out, or they fasted and repented. And so fasting is just a normal thing with Christian church and with Judaism all the way back. And somehow, and Ken will have to tell me why, we got away from that. I don't know why. And you look at the Orthodox Church, they still do it a lot because they haven't changed. They're still the same way they did it way back then, and all the other churches have changed. So I don't know why that is that they've changed, but that would be a great idea to go back to fasting because it's so good for your body. I mean, suppose you go home and you buy stuff and you put it in your house, and then you buy tables and chairs and you use it, and you buy bed stuff and you use the beds, and you just never clean up. What's your house going to look like? It's going to be this big jumbled mess of junk. Our body's the same way. You eat and you have to digest it. So like a lion eats and it lays down, it doesn't do anything for 12 hours or a day or 3 days because it just lays there. It's digesting. So we eat, you know, and we have to digest, and then it has to get assimilated into our body, and then we use all those things. So you do that at breakfast. And you do it, and then lunch comes along, and all of a sudden you're putting more in. Okay, you've got to digest it. You've got to assimilate it, and then you have to use it. And then all of a sudden dinner comes along, and you do that, and you have a snack in the evening and got to eat something before I go to bed. And so the idea of breakfast, is you're breaking a fast. And so our bodies, we didn't always have abundance. We couldn't just eat morning and evening. It was never there.
Yeah.
You had to wait. When I was a kid, we didn't snack. If you didn't eat dinner, you didn't get anything. I said, but I'm hungry. They said, too bad, you didn't eat dinner. Wait a minute. I should. And now moms and dads, have a snack here, little Johnny. Have a snack here. Have a snack in the morning. Have a snack here. Have a snack at night. Don't want to be hungry. Well, so our body needs time to clean house. And so if you need to have a period of time. If you eat until 10 at night and then you eat again at 6 in the morning, you know, you've had 8 hours, which your body's taking the food in. It absorbs it. It digests it. It starts assimilating it. And then you have to use it. It's had no time to clean up. And so what we found, and I've probably read things about fasting now for the past 5 years, and have talks on it and how important it is, no matter how you do it, because it gives time for your body to clean house. And so like Ken said, there's this two-day, five-day thing. You eat for 5 days. You fast for 2 days. I mean, that's okay. That's a little brutal to me because I just can't do that because it's just hard because you're flipping back and forth. And so people have come to intermittent fasting, that kind, or shrinking the time of the day. And so I think that's actually an easier way to do it. You know, say people say, don't you need breakfast? Well, if you're a little tiny human being growing, you do. And instead of growing up, if we're growing out, you probably don't. And so the idea is that for
growing up and growing out.
Growing up and growing out. So for children, it's vital to have 3 meals. They need breakfast. But for adults, we don't. And so I try to eat not before noon or 10, and then I eat after 6. And so the one way commonly is 8:16. So you eat for 8 hours a day, and you then don't for 16. And there's so many good things that happen at those last 4 or 5 hours, because things that happen are your blood sugar comes down. You're not putting anything in, your blood sugar comes down, which is just healthy, because the more your blood sugar is high, it starts wreaking havoc in your body all the time. And the second thing is autophagy, autophagy. So you're automatically eating up your body. And so the most amazing thing, as I study this in the last just couple of months, is that your body has an amazing ability to clean itself up. So you're making proteins and fats and carbohydrates, and you're breaking them down, you're building things and taking them down, and stuff just gets up around. You just get things. And so your body will actually go to that stuff and start using it as energy and kind of cleaning house. And so, you know, you said hunger. We don't like hunger. Well, you know, I actually kind of like it now in the fact that I would just eat and never be hungry, because I just, you know, it's time to eat. Eat, 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 and I eat. And now, if I get hungry at 10, I kind of like it. That's good. I feel hungry. And some people say, I'm starved in the morning. Well, then eat, you know, but don't try to have a really early dinner. Eat at 4 or 5. Yeah. If you're going to be 8 or 9 in the morning, then stop at 4 or 5. And they go, well, I like eating at night too. Well, tough. You know, I prefer to be fuller and have a good dinner, and then I'm not hungry at night. Because that's when I can eat 1,000 calories in an hour in the evening. Especially if it's peanut M&Ms, I can eat 2,000. Yeah.
If it's ice cream, yeah.
Or ice cream.
I'm right there with you.
So you call that intermittent fasting.
It is an odd term, but when you look at intermittent fasting in the literature, it is either the 2-5 day kind of a thing. But this also, this shrinking of the time, is also termed intermittent fasting, which is a little bit odd, but that's the way it is all the way through the literature. And it seems to be the easiest way to do it for me.
Very good. I want to close, Joe, on Jim's reference to the Apostle Paul. I think all of us around this table recognize when we look to the New Testament, Paul wrote 13 of the New Testament books. I see him as a very significant apostle of Jesus. He's a unique one. He wasn't one of the original 12, but he's the one that kind of tells us this is what the coming of the Messiah means in light of the Old Testament. But a lot of times when we think of the struggles we have in life, and it doesn't have to be eating, although it's a struggle a lot of us have, I think we need to recognize to live the Christian life, we need a claim on God's forgiveness. We need to recognize that we can go back to the Lord and say, Lord, I have sinned, forgive me. And you know, Jim, you make a powerful point. Here is the Apostle Paul that I kind of consider the model. He's kind of the model Christian for me. And yet, in the book of Romans, he mentions that he struggles. And one of the reasons I like Augustine so much is that he is the father of grace in the Western Church. Paul is a person who tells us that we can struggle and still find forgiveness and still continue to grow. Jim, it's been a pleasure not only having you on our program, but having you here at RTB. Your talks they're clear, they're funny, they're engaging, and I think you've been really good for all of us. So thank you.
It has been a joy being here.
Good.
All right. Thank you again. Can people reach you in some way or find you on the internet? Have you written more about this topic?
Yeah, it's not really. I have a website. It's okay. It's drjimpainter.com, but I don't even use it very much. You know, people put stuff up. My students put stuff up, so they can look to that if they want. There's a bunch of stuff. If they Google Jim Painter, then there's videos all over the place.
Okay,
completely
good.
Unorganized and just out there.
All right, but I'm sure you've piqued curiosity, and I'm sure people will want to know a little bit more and obtain resources. So that's drjimpainter.com?
Yep.
All right, there you have it. All right, that's going to wrap it up for this podcast. For Ken Samples and Dave Rogstad and our guest, Dr. Jim Painter, this is Joe Aguirre with a reminder that the goal of apologetics is not victory but truth. Thanks for listening, and join us for the next edition of Straight Thinking.
Thank you for listening. Your prayers and financial support are reaching people with reasons for faith in Jesus Christ, our Creator and Savior. To allow Reasons to Believe programs like this to continue, make your gift today at reasons.org.